I'm Marty Moscoane. If you're thinking about it, chances are we're talking about it on WHYY's Radio Times.
And welcome back to Radio Times. I'm Dave Davies, senior writer for the Philadelphia Daily News, sitting in for Marty Moscoane. My guest, Hans Blix, was at the center of the world stage 3 years ago when he headed a United Nations team that searched for weapons of mass destruction in Saddam Hussein's Iraq. For the past 3 years, though, he's had a new mission, heading an International Commission on Weapons of Mass Destruction. Yesterday, it released its report. It's called Weapons of Terror, Freeing the World of Nuclear, Biological, and Chemical Arms. The report is critical of the United States' apparent disinterest in global approaches to arms control. Hans Blix is a Swedish constitutional lawyer and diplomat who has spent decades working in the area of world disarmament. From 1981 to 1997, he was director of the International Atomic Energy Agency. He's written several books on international affairs and constitutional law, including Disarming Iraq, which recounts his experiences as the chief UN weapons inspector before the U.S.-led invasion. Hans Blix now embarks on the effort to convince world leaders to adopt the 60 recommendations of the Weapons of Mass Destruction Commission. And he joins us this hour in our Philadelphia studio. Hans Blix, welcome to Radio Times.
Thank you very much.
Thanks so much for being with us. The report for this commission writes early on that the climate for agreements on arms control has deteriorated a lot in the past 10 years. In what way?
Well, the most visible case was last year, 2005, when the World Summit at the United Nations adopted a lot of recommendations, but they failed to adopt a single line about arms control, disarmament, and terrorism, because the disagreements are so great. And before that, last year, there was a conference on non-proliferation treaty, and it ended without any declaration, in acrimony and in bitterness. We have also not been moving forward at all with the Convention on Biological Weapons. So you can say that in the last 5 years, at any rate, there's been a serious deterioration in the global approach to it. There have been some approaches bilateral and in limited groups, like the so-called PSI, the Proliferation Security Initiative, under which the U.S. and a number of other states agree that they can intercept ships on the high seas to seize equipment meant for weapons of mass destruction. I think the only case that they reported they found anything was a ship on the way to Libya a couple of years ago. But since then, they have had many maneuvers. But this is a limited approach. It's not a global.
And we once had a comprehensive test ban treaty, which limited nuclear testing. Is that now completely absent?
No, I think that, in a way, it was the peak of the progress on disarmament after the end of the Cold War in the beginning of the 90s. There were some, we thought it was a harvest season for disarmament. Now that the great powers are not scared of each other any longer, well, then they could lower the guard and adopt treaties. And indeed, you had the Chemical Weapons Convention was adopted in that period. Mr. Bush, the president, and Gorbachev agreed on a drastic reduction of doing away with tactical nuclear weapons. And we also had, as you mentioned, the Comprehensive Test Ban Treaty, which was adopted and which also signed by President Clinton in the U.S., but then the U.S. Senate rejected its ratification. And I would think that nothing would change the climate in disarmament in the world more than if the U.S. were to review that and if they were to ratify it.
Now, you make the point early that the United States is less interested in global approaches to international arms control than it was during the Cold War. What's the evidence of that? What's its significance?
Well, I think it might have had its roots in the Iraqi aggression against Kuwait. The U.S. did not know that the Iraqis had weapons of mass destruction at the time. They intervened, and President Bush was very capable and skillful in assembling this alliance against Saddam Hussein at that time. Now, as they invaded Iraq, it was found that they were indeed preparing for nuclear weapons and that they had a program for chemical weapons. We knew that they had that because they'd used chemical weapons against the Iranians during the war with Iran, but also about biological weapons was found out later. So I think that for many in the U.S. leadership, this was a disillusionment with the non-proliferation treaty. Here was a treaty in which Iraq had committed itself, and there was a very verification system for which I was responsible at the time in the International Atomic Energy Agency, and it hadn't worked. So they said, no, multilateral instruments and institutions don't work. At the same time, the U.S. military became the only one really meant anything in the world. They no longer had the Russians. They couldn't really compete. So they felt the strength of the military, and I think that was part of the reason why they turned to the military and say, well, let's use our own forces. And that's also why what they did in 2003 against Iraq.
But even in the 90s, when we had a Democratic administration, not the one that currently took this unilateral action in Iraq, but when Clinton was there, even then you felt that the United States was turning away from international reform.
It was a period in between, and you can see, for instance, that after the terrorist attacks on the embassies, the U.S. embassies in Nairobi and Dar es Salaam, President Clinton ordered attacks with U.S. cruise missiles. One attack was in Afghanistan, and another one was on a chemical factory outside Khartoum. Well, it turned out that the intelligence of that chemical factory was just erroneous, so they lifted their hats and said, sorry about that. Now, that was a military response to something that had to do with terrorism. But at the same time, Clinton and Yeltsin reached an agreement in Helsinki in 1997 about a START III treaty. So that was the peak that would have gone on. Since then, it unraveled when the U.S. withdrew from the ABM treaty, and START II collapsed and START III collapsed. And you can say that it's gone downhill ever since.
What's the significance of the United States moving away from global or multilateral approaches to this issue?
Well, there's been going downhill on the multilateral side, and a great deal of bitterness, and especially at the conference in last year about the non-proliferation treaty. The non-nuclear weapon states said that you promised in 1995 and 2000 that you would actually move towards nuclear disarmament, and we, the non-nuclear weapon states, we promised that against what you to respond to what you said, we are committing ourselves to this treaty forever, without any time limit at all. But in 2005, the U.S. declared that, well, that was something that was of an earlier period, and everybody took that as they going back on their promises. So there was a lot of bitterness about it, and that remains.
We're speaking with Hans Blick. He's the former U.N. weapons inspector in Iraq. More importantly, he is the chair of the Weapons of Mass Destruction Commission, a 14-member commission that recently, just yesterday, released a report on eliminating nuclear, biological, and chemical weapons. This report has 60 recommendations. You held a news conference yesterday. You're hoping that world leaders will pay close attention to them. You know, as I thought about this, it struck me that My day job is writing newspaper stories, and you are confronted here with a problem that a newspaper writer, which is you have many, many facts, many, many important facts. Mm-hmm. Nobody can absorb 60 recommendations. What's the most urgent message that you hope people will get?
Well, maybe you have an easier time than they have in the government, because they cannot simply say this is the most important. Now they seem to be dealing with Iran all the time. But what about North Korea? No mm-hmm. one is talking about North Korea, and mm-hmm. I think that they jolly well ought to devote some attention to
it. You must do more than one thing at a time if you're the government. Yeah. But in terms of what do you want the public to hear, is there a central organizing principle? Is there a central message here?
Yeah, I think the basic one is to change the climate, to return to the multilateral instruments that were discarded or disdained over a period of time. We have to agree that the non-proliferation treaty was not sufficient to hold back Iraq and Libya and North Korea and maybe Iran if they are going for nuclear weapons. But then the answer to that, I think after the Iraq war, we can say that is not war, not military means. Maybe the stick will be somewhere in the corner.
The answer to a growing threat is not an invasion.
It's not an invasion. That was patently in the case of Iraq. They did not succeed in eliminating Iraqi nuclear weapons because they were not there.
So right.
That was not a very good answer. And today they're discussing whether military means would be something from Iran for Iran, and I think that most people say that no. Now, in the wake of that, having discovered that the military was not a panacea, maybe one should say, can we fix the multilateral? Can we have all the world with us, as the whole world stood by the U.S. after 9/11? There was a solidarity with the United States all around the world, including China and Russia, etc. Now, today, that is gone. The unilateralism and the attention to the military side has alienated much of the world, and the US, views of the U.S. very, very critical. And I think many people around the world, they long for the U.S. again to be the lead wolf rather than the lone wolf.
And do you think that the lone wolves in Washington have been humbled by the experience in Iraq and are more willing to embrace an international approach?
Well, there's a whole flock of wolves in Washington, and some are are more angry than others. No, I think there is a lot of realization that there is a limitation to what you can achieve by military means. See, during the Cold War, they had to exercise a restraint because they had a dangerous Russian side, people on the other side. Now, after the Cold War, it is self-restraint that will be needed. It's not easy to be a superpower. I recognize. I come from a small country. I understand it's not easy to be a superpower either. But I think that they will need to see is they have the power, but how do we exercise self-restraint? Where do we use it? Where don't we?
This book, this report, which I have to say, I will tell our listeners, actually is quite readable as a text. I mean, although the recommendations are in some moments dense and technical, there is a narrative here which is easy to follow and has a lot of very accessible information. But it is a broad global approach, and often events in the world move incrementally. And I'm wondering if I could get you to talk a little bit about some of the specific challenges we face.
Right.
The one in the news right now is Iran. The United States recently said it would engage in talks with Iran about its weapons program, but only if they would cease the enrichment of uranium. The Iranians, I believe, have told them to go take a leap. What would be helpful in the near term in the situation in Iran?
Well, I hope that the agreement between the U.S. and the U.K. and the others, including Russia and China, that will succeed and lead to a solution. But I must admit that I think it is a little peculiar that what they seem to be saying is that we are ready to sit down and discuss with you the suspension, renunciation of enrichment of uranium and what goodies we will give you for that. But first you have to suspend the enrichment of uranium. I mean, if I were the Iranian, I would say, what kind of suggestion for negotiations are this? And I think often the psychological element is disregarded. But it's sort of humiliating to the other side. Say, well, be a good child. Either you get the goodies here or else you get the punishment. And we are talking to people who have a dignity of their own. Maybe we don't like what they're doing. We may not like the system they're setting up. But there are people who have a long history and have a lot of dignity. And I think that psychologically, it's not a good approach. I think it would have been, everybody knows that there are sticks in the corner and that they can be used. But I think that one should try to see what is it moves the Iranians towards weapons, if they are moving towards weapons. It's not absolutely sure, though most people seem to think so. And then I think you would have to look at the question of security. Who, we say, Iran threatens the world. Now, will the Iranians say that there are 130,000 American soldiers in Iraq, and there are American bases in Pakistan and Afghanistan, and they are also setting up connections with the countries north of Iran? So who are they worried about? The program on enrichment started in the 1980s, so clearly that was geared to Iraq. And the Iraqis indeed were working on nuclear weapons at the time. It was not directed against Israel at the time. That has been very slow development. It started in the 80s, and only now have they succeeded in enriching 1 milligram of uranium. It's going to be very slow.
It would probably be hard for a lot of Americans to take the notion that Iran is fearful of the United States. I mean, do you think that's actually there is an argument for this, right?
Well, how would
let me ask you to hold that thought because we're running up against a break and we'll come right back to it.
Okay.
We're speaking with Hans Blix. He was the former UN weapons inspector in Iraq. His more important task right now is spreading the word of the Weapons of Mass Destruction Commission, which has just released its report called Weapons of Terror. We'll talk more about the report and some about his experience in Iraq right after this break. You're listening to Radio Times. We'll be right back.
Supporting WHYY, Gratz College, honoring Jewish World War II veterans in a program entitled The Finest Hour, World War II and the Jews Who Fought It, Tuesday evening, June 6th. Due to large response, the event has been moved to Congregation Knesset Israel, 8339 Old York Road in Elkins Park. A reception begins at 7 p.m. with a lecture by Bonnie Gurewitch of the Museum of Jewish Heritage at 8 p.m. The event is open to the public. For details, 215-635-7300.
On the next Fresh Air, comic Sarah Silverman. She's been described in Entertainment Weekly as the funniest and lewdest woman in America. Her concert movie, Jesus is Magic, is being released on DVD. Join us for the next Fresh Air.
This afternoon at 3 and again tonight at 7 here on WHYY 91 FM.
I'm Robin Young. Join us next time for the news and these stories here and now. It's the talk of the mountaineering world. A climber is left to die on Mount Everest. We'll speak to one man who defends his decision not to save another. Also, teenagers take on Mahler. That's Public Radio's daily digest of news and culture here and now. Today at noon on WHYY.
Welcome back to Radio Times. I'm Dave Davies in for Marty Moskowain. Our conversation this morning is with Hans Blix. He is the chair of the Weapons of Mass Destruction Commission, which has just released a report with 60 recommendations for freeing the world of nuclear, biological, and chemical arms. You know, Hans Blix, I read a piece about you that was written 24 years ago in the New York Times by, of all people, Judith Miller. in which you were talking about international disarmament, and you said to her, you can't stop proliferation by safeguards. Security considerations are decisive. If a country feels secure, it is more likely to invite us in. Insecure countries are more likely to seek atomic weapons. Now, this, of course, resonates with the point you were making before the break about Iran apparently pursuing a weapons program and the need to give them some assurance on their security concerns. And I was saying, well, a lot of Americans would choke at the notion that any Middle Eastern country would think they have anything to fear from the benevolent forces of the United States. What is Iran's history and perspective on this?
Well, if there's a history in 1953 when the CIA managed to oust one of the first democratically elected Iranian governments, Mr. Mossadegh. And who do they get instead? They got the Shah instead, who set up a strong rule. And
with enormous assistance and military cooperation from the United
and
States.
And then, as a reaction to that, you got the mullahs coming in. So I don't think that the Iranians are forgotten that the U.S. could be subversive. They may be themselves and supporting terrorism, as you said, that's possible. But certainly the U.S. were using subversive means in order to get rid of Mossadegh. And if you look at the situation today, even though you will feel that you are very benevolent and no one could imagine that nice Uncle Sam would do anything to them, nevertheless, well, they saw the invasion of Iraq. And they see the public discussion in the U.S. about the targeting of places in Iran. I don't think it myself that is entirely out of question that the U.S. could take a decision to bomb various places in Iraq. So I think it's entirely plausible that they are indeed worried about the U.S. from the military point of view.
You made the point earlier that you think that the invasion of Iraq has demonstrated a failure of a unilateral action to stop a.
But I wouldn't put it on them to do it again.
Right. Well, I wanted to ask you, technically, I mean, I think a lot of people feel that it sort of isn't realistic to have a nuclear strike which would take out Iranian production of fissionable material.
I agree with that on that judgment, but they could indeed use non-nuclear methods in targets in Iran that they have identified. That I think the Iranians would worry about. Now, the result would probably be even stronger. If they haven't decided before to go for nuclear weapons, I think that would be the result of such an attack. And I think that by and large, the U.S. leadership is sincere in saying that they're not looking for a military solution, but I'm not at all sure that the Iranians will feel secure about that.
And how do you reassure them? Because as you said all those years ago, you have to make them feel secure.
Look at how the U.S. is discussing with North Korea. There they are saying that, yes, we are willing to assure them that we will not attack them. And moreover, they're even saying that we might assist in establishing diplomatic relations with the U.S. and with Japan. And lately, we even heard public discussions about a peace treaty with North Korea. Now, these are all ways in which you assure them that, look here, we don't like your regime, no. But the only thing we care about is don't be dangerous, don't go ahead with your missile program, and don't go ahead with your nuclear program. I think that's good. And clearly, in the case of Iran, you also need to have the issue of security coming up.
You said a moment ago if I recall it correctly, the single most important thing that could occur in this area is the adoption of a comprehensive test ban treaty.
Yes.
Why?
Well, this is something that's been discussed for over 50 years, and we got the partial test ban treaty rather early, and that during President Kennedy's period, and that helped us to avoid having the fallout in the atmosphere. It was environmentally, the testing in the atmosphere were horrible. Now, since
tests
then,
were limited to underground tests,
yeah,
in that.
After that, you could have tests only underwater and in the ground, and not in the atmosphere. Now, we have been discussing since all that period, how can we stop also attend the testing on the ground. And if you stop the testing on the ground, it means also that you will impede and make more difficult any development of new weapons.
Because someone, no one can develop a weapon system without
they
a test?
They can. In the U.S., they certainly can. But there are some things that may be difficult for them to develop, to do. So it would impede other countries and would impede the U.S. as well. The way I read the negative attitude here is that they rather preserve the freedom for themselves to test in the future.
In the United States, even at
the expense and risk that others might test. So if the U.S. were to ratify that treaty, I'm pretty sure China would also. And if China did, India would. If India did, Pakistan would. If Pakistan would, then Iran would, and so forth. There would be a good domino effect on this. And I think the whole the rest of the world practically, maybe North Koreans would extract a prize for joining it, but otherwise the world would go along with that. So the key lies in Washington.
Now, I guess a nuclear test is something that is fairly easy to monitor. I mean, no one can do that behind closed doors.
Absolutely, yeah.
But would a test ban prohibition prevent Iran from developing its nuclear weapons?
No, they might still work on enrichment is the basis they need, enriched uranium for that. They could continue on that, but they couldn't test the weapon. That they would be picked up on that one if they breached that treaty.
What about the general subject of inspections and verification? I mean, this is something you've spent much of your life on.
Yes.
What does the commission have to say about? I mean, it is very hard to tell. I mean, there are a lot of it doesn't take a lot of room to have a process to enrich uranium, does it? I mean.
Oh, yes. For an enrichment plant, it takes a fair amount of infrastructure to do.
So not so easy to do.
It's a big installation. You are likely to discover it from the air. In the case of Iran, they did not. It was underground, but it was discovered. You don't do it in the garage. I mean, with biological weapons, you may fear that they can be done in a small place, but not so with nuclear. The techniques of verification have improved very much. Maybe before the Iraq war in 1991, the IAEA, International Atomic Energy, did not have the right for very intrusive inspections. Because the system was set up in the 1970s and countries were not very used to having inspectors milling around in their factories. But after it was discovered what the Iraqis had been doing, then there was much greater readiness to accept the intrusive inspection. So we got a new system through in 1997. It still has to be adopted and accepted by all states, which is not the case yet. But my point is that international inspection is a very valuable feature that the world is getting used to. And it is not something that replaces in national intelligence. We saw in the war 2003 that the U.S. relied upon its intelligence and they discarded what they heard from the inspectors. And I think the rule should be that you have both, because national intelligence can eavesdrop, they have spies, and they have a lot of other things. Now, but they are not on the ground. The inspectors can go in anywhere, so you need this cooperation. And it's also important that the international inspectors are not remote controlled by the national intelligence, because then they lose the confidence of the world. And in the 90s, the inspectors of the UN were infiltrated by the CIA and others, and they did lose the confidence. Whereas we, UNMOVIC, we were independent, and the U.S. accepted that independence, and I think for that reason we stood much stronger. And indeed, we came to a result that was close to the truth,
right,
which they did not.
Right. And the So your point about inspections, but now that the world is more used to a more intrusive inspection regimen, there's greater belief that an international convention, international treaties, will actually be adhered to.
That's right. And you have an acute case today, and that is a draft treaty on the prohibition of the production of enriched uranium and plutonium for weapons purposes. And the U.S. has presented a proposal on that in Geneva only a few days ago. But it is absolutely empty on the question of verification. They don't want to have any verification.
Wait, you're saying the United States does not want verification on this?
Right.
And
they
why?
It's hard to understand. I don't quite understand why not. Sometimes they say it doesn't work, and yet we have verification of enrichment plants in Brazil, and we have it in Japan, and I think the United States warmly support that, and they haven't said that it doesn't work.
And just to clarify, we're talking about those processes which create the fuel that is
that's
necessary for a nuclear bomb,
absolutely,
either enriching uranium,
yes,
or I guess spent uranium can be enriched to make plutonium, right?
That's right. But for when you want enriched uranium, then you have hexafluoride, this comes from raw uranium, and you enrich that.
And you're saying the United States has a treaty on this, but without verification.
That's right. The idea is that through this treaty, we should turn off the tap to any more material to be put into bombs. And if you combine that with dismantling nuclear weapons, then you have also started the way out of the nuclear weapons era. And the U.S. is willing to turn off the tap, but they have not been willing to propose and accept verification, which the rest of the world does.
We're speaking with Hans Blick. He is the chairman of the Weapons of Mass Destruction Commission, which has just released a report called Weapons of Terror. It has 60 recommendations for freeing the world of nuclear, biological, and chemical arms. We'll be taking some phone calls in a few minutes. If you want to give us a call, the number is 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. The report says that there are three major challenges in this area, in the area of nuclear weapons. There are the existing nuclear states, there are states that are seeking to acquire nuclear weapons, and then there are terrorists. And it's been written fairly extensively that there are hundreds, probably thousands, of nuclear weapons in the former Soviet bloc, some of them which could be carried in something small, you know, a truck, a suitcase even. What does the commission propose about that issue, non-state actors and their ability to steal or buy nuclear weapons?
It is not a very controversial issue. I think everybody, including the Russians and the Americans, are agreed that, yes, we must have better locks, we must have better supervision of it. And this has been going on since the early 90s, since the end of the Cold War. So a lot of more locks have been put on the installations in Russia. But there are still risks, and we are talking about sort of clean-up operation in the world, not so much directed to the actual weapons as to weapons material, the stealing of highly rich uranium or plutonium or equipment of that kind. And we have a sort of possibility of taking the temperature on that in seeing how much trafficking is there in such material. This is reported to the IAEA, and most of the trafficking has really been scams. These are fraudulent people, criminals who sell something they call red mercury, which is not really dangerous. They grab some money and then they disappear. There are some small quantities also of highly enriched uranium that occur, but it's relatively little size in this operation. And therefore, I don't think one is so worried about terrorists building nuclear weapons. There is a little more concern about the possibility of so-called dirty bombs. Now, dirty bombs would contain material that is radioactive, like cobalt or like cesium.
It's not a nuclear-powered explosion. It's a conventional explosion which releases radiation in a populated area.
That is correct.
Right.
If you drop it in a public area, you will have contamination, you will have radiation. Relatively few people probably would be killed or injured by it, but it will spread a lot of terror, a lot of panic. Now, that will be easy to collect because these sources, like cobalt, they are in many places, in hospitals for cancer treatment, etc., and in industry. So that's the greatest scare when it comes to nuclear.
When you said this is largely a non-controversial issue, I guess what you assume that there is an international consensus that we don't want non-state actors and terrorist groups getting these weapons. But I guess I'm wondering how much of a threat it is. Graham Allison wrote a book recently in which he had some rather alarming descriptions of the lack of security at a lot of these former Soviet bloc nuclear facilities.
Well, that's a matter of judgment. I know Graham Allison. I read the book also, and I think that it's somewhat exaggerated. The book is now a couple of years old, and I think most of the other experts would say, yes, there is a problem. He's right to calling our attention to it, but it's perhaps not the most acute.
A lot of the specific recommendations deal specifically with the United States and Russia. I mean, you've made the point that we want international, global approaches. Why so many recommendations dealing with that bilateral issue?
Well, if we are talking about the danger of nuclear weapons in the world, we have to recognize the fact that most nuclear weapons are in Russia and the United States. I mean, there are about, in the world altogether, about 27,000 nuclear weapons, and 12,000 of them are active. And in the U.S. and in Russia, you have a lot of them on hair trigger alert. I mean, there could be mistakes, there could be misunderstandings, technical errors, and that could be released by accident. So we think that it's important that they move further down in the disarmament. They have moved down. At when the peak of the possession of nuclear weapons, we had about 50,000, I think, in the world, and now this is down to 20,000. But they could go much further down than that and much faster than they have agreed under the latest agreement between Moscow and Washington.
Talk a little bit about the situation in India. You were saying that the United States needs to take an aggressive look at that situation and how it's going to deal with India and Pakistan.
Well, there is a draft, a proposed agreement between the U.S. and India on nuclear cooperation in the civilian sphere. And the Commission discusses that and recognizes that this agreement has many aspects. One aspect is that of energy. And it's clear that if a country like India and also like China, if they are using more nuclear power, there will be some restraint in their need for the fossil fuels, and also hence, as a result, less emissions of carbon dioxide. The greenhouse effect would thereby be touched. However, the fear has been expressed in the US and elsewhere that if India is able to import more uranium, maybe they could use more of their own uranium for adding to their nuclear arsenal. And that would go against the US commitment to the Non-Proliferation Treaty, which prohibits the US from assisting any other country in making more nuclear weapons. Now, there would be ways out of that, and the Commission points to two measures that would be helpful. One would be precisely the treaty to stop any further production of enriched uranium or plutonium in India for weapons. Now, it may be hard to achieve for the U.S. to say, you, India, will do it, but we will not do it in the U.S. So I think that points again to this worldwide treaty. The other treaty that would be desirable to get India to accept would be the comprehensive test ban, that they would not go any further on in the nuclear weapons sphere. Again, India would probably do that, accept such a treaty, if the U.S. did. So these two things, I think, point to the need for the U.S. to go back to multilateralism and take two treaties which are very important for the whole of the world, not only for the Indian case, but the Indian case demonstrates the acute need of them.
One of the things that the report talks about is examples where you can have regional agreements on disarmament, and if there's a region that needs it, it's the Middle East, and there's talk of a nuclear-free zone in the Middle East. Your view seems to be great idea. Oh. hopefully it's not President Bush calling you. I'll call you to want to return right away. The idea of a nuclear-free zone in the Middle East, this obviously confronts the fact that there is a nuclear power in the Middle East. Does this idea have any currency? Can it get anywhere?
At the moment, no. But the idea has been on the table for a long time, and all the countries in the Middle East, including Israel, votes in favor of a zone free weapons mass destruction in the Middle East. But I don't think it can move apart from a peace process going on. It may be indispensable as a part of that peace process, but not independent of the peace process. And the Commission has not done more than sigh and say this is something that has to come in the future. But it does have some ideas as to what could be done now. We are looking at Iran and saying that it would be desirable that they stop enriching uranium, that they would not move further on the enrichment of uranium. We also see that similarly in the case of Korea, both North Korea and South Korea will abstain from enrichment of uranium and reprocessing. Now the Commission asks, could one not do something similar in the Middle East? That is not as far-reaching a proposal as a zone free weapons mass destruction. But could we ask the countries in the Middle East, Iran, Israel, Syria, Egypt, Saudi Arabia, to refrain from either from enriching uranium in the case of Iran or reprocessing to plutonium in the case of Israel? Israel has already, we assume, about 200 nuclear weapons anyway, and they would keep them as a life insurance, I'm sure.
A trust-building step?
Yes, it would be a confidence-building measure. It would be a modest step towards a zone-free weapons of mass destruction. But it might also help make it easier for the Iranians to accept doing away with enrichment in Iran if they were to see that Israel were to do something.
Okay. Our guest is Hans Blick. He is the former UN's weapons inspector in Iraq. He wrote a book. They're called Disarming Iraq. His latest work is Weapons of Terror. He and other members of the Commission on Weapons of Mass Destruction have released this report, which has 60 recommendations on freeing the world of nuclear, biological, and chemical arms. We'll be talking about that and a bit about his Iraq experience when we return. The number to call if you'd like to speak with Hans Blick, 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-9499. WHYY. We'll be right back.
WHYY is supported by Interact Theater Company, currently presenting the Philadelphia premiere of Since Africa, the story of a recently widowed socialite and an African-American clergyman who clash over how to help one of the lost boys of Sudan acclimate to life in urban Chicago. Since Africa shows how four extraordinary people grapple with loss, identity, and the challenges of creating a new home. Tickets and information are available at interacttheater.org.
I'm Margaret Cho, your host for Crossing East. Well, in Vietnam, if you live with a GI, then they think you're part of two.
I am Chinese, Greek, Swedish, English, Scottish, German, Pennsylvania, Dutch.
I was born in Changsha. I don't know exactly what day they estimated the day.
Brides and Children on Crossing East.
Tonight at 11 o'clock on WHYY.
Next time on Day to Day.
Investors in precious metals are thrilled by a rise in gold prices.
But could the latest case of gold fever have a chilling effect on the economy?
You hope that you're wrong in buying it. Because if you're right in buying it, all your other assets are going to be in big trouble.
Who's going for the gold?
The silver and platinum, for that matter.
And why, next time on Day to Day.
This afternoon at 1 on WHYY.
Welcome back to Radio Times. I'm Dave Davies in for Marty Moscow-Wayne. Our guest is Hans Blix. He is the chairman of the Weapons of Mass Destruction Commission, which has just released a report called Weapons of Terror, making 60 recommendations on nuclear, chemical, and biological weapons. Well, Hans Blix, you were at the center of an international maelstrom 3 years ago when you led a UN weapons inspection team, did 700 inspections in Iraq for weapons of mass destruction, and said you didn't find any, but you couldn't be sure because there were clearly materials unaccounted for. With more time, maybe you could reach a definitive conclusion. The United States got quite impatient and in the end invaded Iraq. I heard you make a point recently about that experience and the role of national intelligence like the CIA and how they fit into an international verification regime. What did you guys at the UN do that the national intelligence agencies didn't?
Well, the inspectors had the right under the mandate of the Security Council to go in anywhere in Iraq to meet any people they wanted and to interrogate them. And we did so. The U.S. and other intelligence, they might have had some spies on the ground. They had satellite pictures, but we also had satellite pictures. They had eavesdropping, and some of the evidence that Colin Powell presented were eavesdropped telephone conversation. I'm not negative to national intelligence. I think in times of terrorism, you need that in all countries. But I think that the resources they have should be put to use to add to the ability of the international inspectors. I remember an occasion when President Bush said that we have seen how installations that were devoted to nuclear matters before, they had been extended. Well, there were more roofs, but when the inspectors came there, there was nothing under the roofs. And so it shows that being on the ground and having the right to go in is a very important thing. And seeing things on satellites is also important. What's also important is that the international inspectors not be remote controlled by the national, that it not be seen as tools of the international, because then the cooperation with the authorities on the ground will be very bad, and also the world confidence in the inspectors' impartiality will be gone.
When Colin Powell went to the United Nations and made that presentation with satellite photos and other evidence, which the United States thought was a compelling case that Saddam Hussein was indeed pursuing a weapons of mass destruction program, what was your reaction watching that?
Well, my feeling was simply that, well, this is interesting stuff. Here's a prosecutor putting evidence on the table. Let me have my experts examine each of this evidence and see how credible it is. And they did. And we came up with a couple of cases where we could check it. There were things we couldn't check. I mean, eavesdropped conversations we could not check. They might be true. Or we don't know whether it was an Iraqi talked or whether it was some guy from Chalabi's camp. We couldn't say anything about that. But I said that, no, we have found such weaknesses that I have to say something about it. And I did that in the Security Council. It was about a site in which the U.S. alleged that there were chemical weapons. And I said that did not square with the evidence we had. So I went as far as that. I don't think it was appreciated, but we were right.
Did the Bush administration wage a smear campaign against you?
No, I would say that my relations with Colin Powell, with Condoleezza Rice and Negro Ponte, the ambassador in New York, were very correct all the way through. Our relations with the CIA and U.S. intelligence were also correct. What was a smear campaign were the media. Some of the newspapers were sort of slices alive, but I didn't have much time to read them. I read the bigger newspaper.
Well, there were kind of like rumors that people were casting out about your life and things like that. You didn't attribute that to government planted stories?
I don't know. I mean, I
you were too busy doing your job.
I was too busy to concern myself about it. The Iraqis were pretty good at smearing me too.
Right. Hated by both sides. Maybe that means you're doing your job. It occurred to me that the Iraqi government did not want to cooperate with you, and there were a lot of materials that they could not account for and did not want to be held accountable for. And it's often occurred to me that it's sort of ironic that if Saddam Hussein had actually opened his books and provided everything to you, I mean, it's ironic that of all the horrendous crimes he's committed, it may be that the one that brought his downfall was one he might have been innocent of. He may not really have had any programs.
No, it's in a way a puzzle why they did not come earlier during the 90s to demonstrate better that they didn't have anything. Now, it is true that lots of things were unaccounted for. In Washington, I think that was frequently taken for, if it is not accounted for, where is it? Whereas the correct question is it there or is it not there? And in fact, it was not there. A possible explanation why Saddam did not sort of contradict or counteract the impression that there still was something, because they did stop the inspectors in the 90s. They didn't stop us, but they stopped the inspectors in the 90s. Might have been that he wanted to have the cake and eat it. He wanted to say to the UN, you should stop all the sanctions because I have nothing. And at the same time, he wanted to say to Iran and to the others that, look, I'm still dangerous. Mm-hmm. So it was like hanging a sign on the door, beware of the dog, without having a dog.
Right. all right, let's get to a couple of callers. Gary's been holding on from Center City. Are you there, Gary?
Yes, Jerry. How you doing, Dave?
Oh, Jerry, good. Go ahead.
How you doing, Mr. Blix? I have a question for you about this sort of diplomacy that we've been having here. Winston Churchill had said that in World War II that England has no friends. It only has temporary allegiances of convenience, and I thought that was very applicable to what's happening today. What I see and what I'm worried about is that we tend to, the U.S. government, go over into other countries, sovereign nations, and do inspections and invasions, and we get involved with these complicated sort of game theory-like bluffing games with people like Saddam and with Afghanistan versus Russia, and we supply them weapons, and then we later have to deal with repercussions from that. Don't you think it would be a better strategy? The American people right now are very concerned about borders and ports to do the inspections sort of here, and how could we leave these gaping holes around our own country, and yet we can go into other countries and look for like a needle in a haystack, something
okay, Jerry.
That's almost impossible to find.
Thanks, Jerry. Let's
talk on the
subject. Go ahead, Hans Blix.
Yes, I think that it's important to guard your own borders, and a good deal is done by that, is realize that terrorists might try to smuggle things, and there's control about containers nowadays, and the borders are where they're much more difficult to get visa, and there's a quarrel between the European Union and the United States as to how much information should the U.S. have from the airliners about our diet habits and whatnot. But I mean, it's justified to try to guard yourself against terrorism and your own border. You also have the immigration problem, which is separate one. Now, I wouldn't say that you should do this only, you should switch to that and forget about the others. We are interested in reducing the threats from abroad. And Iran acquire, if they were to go for nuclear weapons, and most people in the U.S. seems to be convinced that that's the case. I don't think, after having seen what they've made of the evidence in Iraq, one should be a little cautious about judging the evidence also in the case of Iran. But it is important that the world together, not just the U.S., but the world together, come to grips with this problem. What I'm a little worried about is simply that you treat countries like Iran or North Korea as children, and they say that you would better behave, and if you don't behave, we'll spank you. We will give you a goodie if you behave, and we'll spank you. I think that's counterproductive. So I don't wish the U.S. to go back to an isolationism. You can't in this world of HIV and SARS and avian flu, etc. That's not really possible, even if some people would like to.
We're speaking with Hans Blix. He is the chairman of the Weapons of Mass Destruction Commission, which has just released its report with 60 recommendations. Number to call, 1-888-477-9499. Peter is with us from Camden County, New Jersey. Peter?
Yes, hello.
Go ahead.
And hello, Mr. Blix.
Hello.
It's an honor to talk to you. In the course of your presentation this morning, on a couple of occasions, and I'm not just trying to lay blame or anything, but I think that there's a certain attitude that needs to be addressed, and that is you've criticized the psychology of the United States with comments like, you wouldn't put it past the United States to stage a conventional attack on Iran's nuclear facilities, and the key to nonproliferation lies in Washington, and the United States shouldn't treat other countries like children. But then you frequently seem to excuse Arabic psychology with statements like, Iraq will possibly build nuclear weapons, but, you know, we're not sure, and Iran will possibly build nuclear weapons, and we're not sure, and Iran can possibly be subversive.
Okay,
but
Peter,
let's
wrap up a quick...
larger forces like pan-Arabic anti-Semitism, which the president of Iran was pandering to when he made his famous announcement about pushing Israel into the sea.
Okay, Peter, a point well made, and I know you have a lot to say, but I want to get a response from Hans Blix. Go ahead.
Well, I agree with it. There's no reason to, and I think you misunderstand me if you think that I put all the difficulties at the side of Washington. I certainly think that Iran should accept and go by the UN Charter, and it's illegal under the UN Charter to threaten a neighbor or a country in the region with aggression. That is unacceptable. He was indeed criticized for it in Iran, in the Iranian parliament. And the whole discussion is about whether we can convince Iran to stay away from enriching uranium, which is not prohibited under the non-proliferation treaty if it's done for peaceful purposes. So I'm thoroughly with the U.S. and with the others in this effort. What I'm discussing is the best ways of getting there. There are many reasons why disarmament has not done well, and I think the view of the U.S. that the multilateral instruments have not worked very well is one of them, but there are others as well. I also can see the advantage of the Proliferation Security Initiative, which I talked about a while. It's a new instrument to complement what has been done before.
That's the thing to interdict weapons or fissionable materials traveling on the high seas.
Yeah, and equipment to produce fissionable material.
Right. Okay, let's go to Marcia, who's in Rocky Hills, New Jersey. You there, Marcia?
Yes, hi, and hello, Mr. Blix.
Hello.
My question is, do you think for all nations to move toward total nuclear disarmament that there needs to be some kind of international arsenal?
Well, we are... taking the view in the Commission that the long-term objective should be a convention outlawing nuclear weapons, that's a production of it, a possession of it, or use of it, in the same way that the world already has conventions against biological weapons and against chemical weapons. But it's long-term. The nuclear weapons cannot be uninvented, and we have many steps to go there. We have succeeded in making the southern hemisphere free from nuclear weapons altogether through nuclear weapon-free zones. The seabed is free from it. The outer space is free from it. But we still have 27,000 nuclear weapons. And then we are looking at instruments like the comprehensive test ban. There would be no further tests of new nuclear weapons. There would be an agreement which would prohibit the production of more material for nuclear weapons. And there would indeed be agreements about reduction of the number of nuclear weapons and dismantling of them. So slowly, slowly, I think we would have to move that. But I think you are right in saying that for a complete disappearance of nuclear weapons, we will also need institutional arrangement. The UN today is not, I think, ready to be the headquarters of an international army. But we are seeing the beginning, the early steps in the peacekeeping operations.
Let me make sure I understand this idea. Are you talking about a one internationally controlled arsenal of nuclear weapons?
I think that's, as I understood you, questioner, that would there have to be an international army, international nuclear weapons?
Oh. So,
yeah. I think that was the question. It's a very long-term view, and we only see the rudimentary first steps of this in the peacekeeping operations. They are no more than, 45 years old, and we see more and more of them. They are helping a lot in places, like in many places in Africa. And we can next step might be that individual countries might hold military units available for the UN in case of crisis. We see more and more of that, but it will be a slow evolution, surely.
Okay, thanks, Marcia. You know, Hans Blix, I have to ask you, it would be hard to find someone better prepared for the task of chairing this commission than you, since you have spent, since 1962, you said, working in the area of international armament. There's so much that you knew. I'm wondering, as you explored the terrain of weapons of mass destruction in the world today, is there anything that surprised you that you learned?
Well, I've been dealing with nuclear weapons most of the time, and I was the executive head of the International Atomic Energy Agency for 16 years. And that was an agency based upon the Atoms for Peace that President Eisenhower brought out. And I say that we must make use of the potential of nuclear energy for peaceful purposes, medicine, agriculture, and also, of course, for generation of electricity. At the same time, we must guard against the misuse of this natural source for weapons purposes. So I'm still with that. I'm still very much in favor of a greater use of peaceful nuclear power, and I'm as much against the nuclear weapons. But you asked me, did I learn something new? Yes, I have not dealt very much with the question of biological weapons before. I haven't dealt so much with the space problems either. So there were new areas, and it's a vast area, even though I lived with these matters. There's still a lot to learn.
The other question I have to ask you, one of my reactions to the attacks of September 11th was to see this is in some respects as a threat to civilization. I mean, the notion that non-state actors could wreak such catastrophic havoc meant that not that they would achieve their religious or political goals, but that it would tear at the fabric of civilization, these things that bind us together. And I'm wondering, in the four decades you've been doing this, are you more optimistic or less, how relatively pessimistic or hopeful are you at human beings' ability to share this planet and create institutions that allow us to live together?
Well, I'm relatively optimistic that in the medium term and long term, we will be able to put an end to the weapons of mass destruction, reduce armaments. The greatest thing that had happened in my rather long diplomatic life is, after all, the finishing of the Cold War, the end of expansive communism, and, of course, the expansion of the developing countries in the world, China, India, etc. I'm relatively hopeful that weapons can be made to play a smaller role, and I'm fearful of the new races that we can see in space, for instance, in space weapons. I must confess that for the longer term, I'm more worried about the environmental side. I'm very worried about the global warming. I'm very worried about species that disappear and about the desertification in Africa. I think that it's not quite as spectacular as the risk of human civilization being obliterated as people feared in the 70s.
Well, maybe that'll be your next career. You're only 77. Well, Hans Blix, we're out of time. I want to thank you so much for coming to join us.
Thank you.
Hans Blix is the former UN's weapons inspector in Iraq, and he is the chairman of the Weapons of Mass Destruction Commission, and they just completed a report, Weapons of Terror, Freeing the World of Nuclear, Biological, and Chemical Arms. He will now spend the next several weeks trying to convince the leaders of the world to adopt its 60 recommendations. Thanks so much for listening. You've been listening to Radio Times. For Marty Moscow-Wayne, I'm Dave Davies. You're listening to WHYY-FM Philadelphia, serving Pennsylvania, New Jersey, and Delaware, now broadcasting in HD Radio.